Our reading this morning is a short reading from Psalm 112. It is written, "A light shines in the dark for honest people, for those who are merciful and kind and good. It is good to be merciful and generous. Those who are fair in everything they do will never be defeated. Good people will be remembered forever." This is the word of the Lord. So this has been a message that has been kind of in my tool chest for the last 2 years. And I always knew that I was going to kind of use it in this service. What I did not plan on is just the perfect timing of it right now on this weekend here in August. And the last few months for me, I'm sure many of you could probably speak into this as well, have been for me, as far as my spiritual growth, some of the most dramatic of my adult life. And that is, I'm seeing things more clearly now than I saw maybe 6 months ago. And that is, at least in part, that every single person here and every person out there bears and carries the image of God. Every person. Which means that everybody's life is infinitely fascinating. If you get to know them, if you get to talk to them. And it stands to reason then that their story, if listened to, affects our own story. And for years in ministry, I always felt this burden. I just never could really define it. I just knew it was there. And that is, I watched people over the years in ministry who were incredibly gifted, or God put a light in them to do something great. And yet for the sadness of life, or mental health, or physical limitations, or they were taken too early, they didn't get a chance to live it out. And I felt a burden for years to carry on what they were trying to accomplish. I think a lot of us in here could identify with that. They were shining the light that was put out too early. And therefore, for me personally, I felt a rage against the dying of their light. And of course, this scripture this morning, I want to put it up here, reminds me of this. Right standing with God, it says there, will literally last forever. Light rises, even when the darkness tries to put it out, for the one who is right. And it says there, their deeds and who they are will be remembered forever. The psalmist also says later on, this up here, one generation shall commend your works to another. Not just with God, but with each other, we continue to pass it and pay it forward. In other words, it's about the light that will live on long after I'm gone, long after you're gone. And I don't know if you ever thought about this, but every word we know about Jesus, everything we know about Jesus Christ came from other people. He never wrote anything himself. But his life so impacted their lives that they wrote it down, and it's now impacted our lives here 2,000 years later. I think on a cosmic scale, that also happens on a lesser scale with each one of us here. And that is because his story became their story, which becomes our story. And because we're made in the image of God, we also share one another's stories. In some instances, other people's light or other people's torch becomes a part of our own that we carry. In other words, their lives inspire us. And I was recently reminded of a quote that I heard years ago, but I was just reminded of recently of the death of a friend. A few weeks before he died, he reminded me of this. I want to put this quote up here, okay? Our dead are never dead to us until we have forgotten them. Isn't that true? And so this morning, I want to tell three improbable stories of people who have impacted my life that happened nearly 25 years ago. The light that they shined has shined in my light and inspired me to be greater than I am. And this all started back when my grandmother had just died. I graduated from college. I moved to Pawleys Island, South Carolina. I was in my early 20s. In the early 90s, I was there. And my grandmother had just died a couple years earlier. And my mother kind of sent me my family history from my grandmother on down. And I remember she wrote this all out, okay? This is my line from my family goes back to George Washington and his sister. That's where my line comes from. And as soon as I might get prideful about it, okay, a little down here, I want to highlight that. My great-great-grandfather, Robert Douthat, owned Wyanoke Plantation, and it was in our family for 100 years, and along with it, he owned 47 slaves. My great-great-grandfather. Let me take this even a step further. This is a picture of my grandmother. I remember her telling me about this, okay? She died in 1991. This is when she's 2 years old, or sorry, she's 1 year old. The woman holding her there, her name is Belle, who she called Mammy, who raised her until she died when my grandmother was 18. She's one of our former slaves. So my grandmother, I used to talked about Belle in my lifetime. And when I was telling one of my friends in Parlezaun about this, I felt shame that I would never tell the story about this. And he began to tell me, he said, Jonathan, that's not the end of the story. This affects your own story and how you can change and how you can bring light into the world. And he began to tell me about his own family. And he says, I don't know if you ever know, but I come from the Lawrence family in South Carolina. And he began to tell me about a young man in his family. I'll put his picture up here. A guy named John Lawrence. Has anybody ever heard of John Lawrence? Okay, look around. Hardly anybody. He's one of the greatest people I've ever come across in the pages of history. Okay, he was born in Charleston. You see there the date. His father was the president of the Continental Congress, Henry Lawrence. He also ran and owned one of the biggest slave trading houses in America. Henry Lawrence did. And somewhere in John Lawrence's teens, he comes to the conviction that slavery is an abomination and a desecration of the image of God. And you know how he arrived at that point? He was reading his Bible. Imagine such a thing. And he goes to his father and he says, we have got to stop this evil. We need to emancipate all 300 of our slaves. Needless to say, his father disagreed. So his son, in anger, goes and joins the revolution and becomes one of the greatest soldiers in the Revolutionary War. He serves under George Washington. And he serves an aide-de-camp at the age of 20. He then comes back to his father at the age of 21, 22. And he says to his father, here's what I want to ask of you. I would ask if you'd give me my inheritance early. Basically, John Lawrence betting on himself. And I want to emancipate 40 of our slaves. And I also want your permission to recruit 300 black militia slaves to fight in the Revolutionary Army with me for their freedom. And I believe I will create a regiment that will be unbeatable. His father said, if you can convince the South Carolina legislature, I will bless it. So Lawrence puts a bill up in the South Carolina Congress, and 1779 is defeated. He gets up the next year, he puts another bill up, and 1780 is defeated. They don't allow him to put up the bill in 1781, so he reintroduces it in 1782. Every single person in the House voted against it. So Lawrence is devastated over this. So he writes his best friend for many years, very close to, okay? I'll put us a picture up here, a man named Alexander Hamilton. Have you heard of him? Yeah, I bet you have, okay? And Lawrence says to Hamilton, to secure our union on solid foundations, he says, Alexander, we have to overturn this evil. So Hamilton writes back a letter to Lawrence and says this, my friend, I want you to put down the sword, put down your guns, I want you to put on the toga, and I want you to come and serve alongside me in Congress. We know each other's sentiments. Our views are the same. We have fought side by side to make America free. Let us, Hamilton says, let us stand hand in hand with each other to make that true for every American. This is what Hamilton writes. The letter never gets to Lawrence because a letter in the mail from Lawrence's father crosses in the mail to Hamilton, which says this, dear Alexander, on Tuesday the 27th, my son was killed in a gunfight against British troops retreating from South Carolina. In fact, a little history note, he was killed right over here in Beaufort on the Cumbie River. As you know, John dreamed of emancipating and recruiting 3,000 men for the first all-black military regiment. And so his dream of freedom for these men dies with him. Remember the quote? Okay, our dead are never dead to us unless we have forgotten them. Okay, and this is where Alexander Hamilton comes into play. He says and makes a vow, I am never, ever, ever going to forget what Lawrence tried to accomplish. And who I think, my opinion is, and I've been saying this for years, the greatest of all the founding fathers, and no one cared 10 years ago, who I call Alexander the Great. Okay, now listen. If you're looking for a perfect person, he ain't it. As James Madison said, he is not a perfect man, he was a great man. And why I fell in love with him years ago is I think his story is the story of all of us. It's a story of providence, God having his hand on him. It's a story of grace. It's an incredible story of failure after failure. It's a story of forgiveness. It's a story of death. It's a story, his life is a story of redemption. And if you think Lauren's story is improbable, his story is 10 times more improbable. And what I mean by that is he was born into poverty. His father abandons him at the age of 10. His mother dies at 12. He becomes an orphan at 12. And the thing that's so tragic, I've listened to 4 biographies on him. Nobody wanted him. Nobody did. So he has scrap and claw for everything, and he just begins to write. A hurricane comes in, destroys the island he lives on in St. Croix, and he writes about his misery and his sadness, and somebody publishes it in the paper, and suddenly the entire island realizes the brilliance of this 17-year-old kid. They raise a collection, and they send him to the United States to get an education. He arrives at Columbia, and graduates faster than anybody ever did in the history of Columbia in 2 years with a law degree. He then gets swept up into the Revolutionary War, and just through incredible improbable events, again, I would say providence, he ends up at the age of 20 serving alongside George Washington. And the thing that's remarkable about this, maybe some of you know his story, Washington becomes the father to Hamilton that Hamilton never had. And Hamilton becomes to Washington the son that Washington never had. And they form, in my opinion, one of the greatest duos in human history. And at the core of their relationship, they want the same thing. They want to turn the states into one single great nation. And here's what's so amazing about this. Okay, So the Revolutionary War ends, Washington becomes president, and he the first guy he names for his cabinet. This is just insane. At the age of 32, he appoints Hamilton to become the Treasury Secretary at 32. I was an idiot at 32, okay? And Hamilton has no financial background at all, other than what he read or what he learned. And Washington comes to him and says, listen, Alexander, our country is teetering over a cliff. We are in debt, the greatest debt in the history of our country, that little short time. And unless we do something, everything we fought for is going to be in vain. And he says to him, he actually says the words, son, I want you to fix it. So Hamilton locks himself away in a closet for basically 90 days. And he comes out of that closet with a 53-page document, okay, that sets in motion the most successful financial system in world history. What we know today is modern capitalism. Hamilton founded the New York Stock Exchange. He founded Wall Street. He created our currency. Every colony had different currency. He created one currency. The money we carry in our pocket is because of him. He literally has his face on the money. He founded the New York Post. He created the Coast Guard. He basically, with James Madison, founded and created the U.S. Constitution and defended it. All of this. Now, here's the thing I want you to know. If it was just these things, that's just public stuff. And I don't think he's any different than Jefferson or Adams or others, but here's what captured my heart 25 years ago, and I began to look at his life. It's what he became near the end of his life. Because in his own words, he would have said that in many ways, as great as people think I am in doing these things, I have failed in many ways because what he was doing was not eternal. That all changed when his 19-year-old son, Philip, was tragically killed, okay? And this kid, I'm telling you, knowing about, he would have been the president of the United States. I'm absolutely convinced of it. He had the best of both his parents. He had the intellect and the charm of his father while having the sensitivity and sophistication of his mother. He's a good-looking kid. And this absolutely destroyed Hamilton. We know he loved this young man with an extraordinary passion because he literally collapsed at his funeral. He couldn't even stand. And we know from, we know it's pretty well known now, his son died trying to defend his father's honor. And what we know from historical documents is that Hamilton at nighttime would walk the streets of New York at all hours of the night, past midnight. He would walk past the streets who he literally created. He would walk down Wall Street. He would walk up Broadway, and people said, and he would cry uncontrollably. But here's the thing that's so remarkable of this. He discovered something about himself that he had lost, and that is he discovered, again, his faith that was real to him. And he begins to ask himself, what is truly important? What do I want to accomplish? And he begins to go to church again. He begins to read his Bible again. He begins to lead his children, his wife, and daily devotions in the morning time and at nighttime. And he begins to ask the question that I'm asking all of you, and that is, what is my legacy? What do I want to leave for people long after I'm gone? And he decides, he makes the time, he said, Lord, whatever time you give me, if anything, I'm going to finally honor the people who've honored me, who've got me here, because no one gets to where they are without other people. So he says to his wife, I'm going to honor George Washington. He also says to his wife privately, I want to begin an orphanage in New York City to help the children just like myself who have absolutely nothing. And then he says, and then I'm going to begin my trek to abolishing slavery, which seemed impossible at the time. And he writes in his journal, okay, and he wrote to a friend, what is my legacy? I want to plant seeds that will grow that I probably will never see. And, you know, the thing is, if you know about his life, he never did see it. And the reason why he never saw it, okay, this is crazy, okay? He was killed by the Vice President of the United States. So when people say, I've never seen this bad in politics, please, okay? And it brings up an interesting thought that I brought up with other people privately. And believe me, I'm not the first person to kind of suggest this. Other people have suggested this as well. What if Hamilton had lived? I would make the argument that I think our country right now would be even greater than it is now. Because if Hamilton had lived, he had repaired his reputation. He would have run against James Madison. He would have beaten James Madison for the presidency. He would have been in office when the England tried to invade America in the War of 1812. Hamilton was one of the last great military people left in the world. He would have smashed the British army. Because you know what he would have done? He would have recruited what Lawrence always wanted, a black militia, and he would have thought we would have been invincible. He would have had almost semi-divine status. Because Canada got involved, Canada would have been a part of the United States, so it would have been the United States of North America. He would have completely changed the voting bloc of America. And then Hamilton absolutely would have said, over the next 25 years, I'm going to make a plan to overturn slavery. And I'm telling you, the man would have done it. He just ran out of time. He ran out of time. But remember, I've said to you over and over again, our dead are never dead to us until we have forgotten them. And during the last 4 or 5 years, when I've talked to people privately, everybody would ask me, have you seen the musical? Have you seen the play? And my answer was always the same, no, okay? And first of all, I don't have $1,000 to go to Broadway, okay? Unless you're willing to pay for it. And they just kind of walk the other way, right? Secondly, erroneously, people told me, well, it's very political. And thirdly, you know, Hamilton's like one of my heroes. And I had this connotation, because I've grown up on hip-hop. I love hip-hop. But I had this connotation that, you know, Alexander Hamilton's going to run out on the stage, and he's going to have this baseball cap to the side, okay, wearing parachute pants, talking about the Constitution while he's breakdancing. And everybody said, Jonathan, you got to see it. You got to see it. And you talk about providence, okay? This is the perfect time. I had no idea they were going to put this out in a movie form that came out on Disney Plus 2 months ago. And so I watched it, skeptical. And I got to say, after I watched it, it is the greatest piece of art I've ever seen. Without discussion for me. I didn't think anything could surpass Bach's Mass in B minor. That did. And I tell you, when I was watching it, about 30 minutes into it, I thought, oh my gosh, this is really good. An hour and a half into it, I thought, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. At the end, tears were rolling down my face. And I actually said a prayer. I actually said a prayer to God. I said, oh my God, Lin-Manuel Miranda did it. He captured the essence of who and the greatness and the flaws of Hamilton. And the thing I was really looking for, I wanted to see, is he going to honor, I think, to me, one of the greatest women in American history who's been completely forgotten, and that is his wife, Eliza. Along with Abigail Adams and Martha Washington, she is the mother of our country. And a woman of incredible faith, deep Christian faith. And I just got to say this, when Hamilton died, everybody thought everything Hamilton fought for and hoped for would die with her. Our dead are never dead to us until we've forgotten them. And this is where Eliza Hamilton comes in. Because after Hamilton died, I mean, he was the only founding father who had no money. He didn't own slaves. So he died and she was destitute. She had 7 children and 2 orphans they had adopted with no money. And we know what she told other people. Every single night she cried herself to sleep, every single night for that first year, to the point where she realized this is not productive, this is not healthy. So she goes to see the minister at Trinity Church on Wall Street, and she said, I don't want to waste all my life on tears. I need to find a way forward. And he says, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? She said, I want to carry on a legacy of those who've gone before me and make it my own. And so they map out a plan, and she goes home that night, and she writes down in her journal, New Beginnings. And I cannot believe Miranda put this in his play. I didn't think in a secular play he would put this in there. But she writes down, and I want to put this in her journal. She says this very thing, Lord, in your loving kindness, give me more time. Give me what my Hamilton did not have. Okay, she was 47 years old when she wrote this down. Now get this. She would live another 50 years. And she would dedicate her life to what she proudly called herself, a foot soldier for the Lord, bringing about a evangelical social work. And she became a champion for women. She became a champion for slaves. She became a champion for the poor, the destitute. She became a champion for orphans. And she grasped the idea of protecting the image of God in every single human being. And the hopes and the dreams and the legacies of others really, I would say, became her own. She's an incredible model for us for this. And because of the gospel, I'm telling you, I know this woman. She was unafraid, which gave her invincible courage. And at the age of 95, the New York Post, okay, the newspaper her husband created, came and interviewed her when her mind was beginning to fade. And she said to them, she said, you know, one of the things I cannot wait, she said, I have 2 feet here in this present world, and yet I'm always keeping my eyes on what me and my Hamilton called that heavenly country. And she said, I cannot wait to see my son again. I cannot wait to see Lawrence. I cannot wait to see my Hamilton again in his laughter, in his smile. And so you got to believe, when I watched the play and they put that in there, I said, oh, I'm using this sucker. Okay. Of her at the very age of the end of her life, looking back on what she accomplished. And you just got to watch this. Let's play this. Watch this.
I put myself back in the narrative. I stop wasting time on tears. I live another 50 years. It's not enough. I interview every soldier who fought by your side.
She tells our story.
I try to make sense of your thousands of pages of writings. You really do write that you're running out of time. I rely on Angelica. While she's alive, we tell your story. She's buried in Trinity Church near you. When I needed her most, she was dying on time. And I'm still not through. I ask myself, what would you do if you had more time? The Lord in his kindness, he gives me what you always wanted. He gives me more time. I raise funds in D.C. for the Washington Monument.
She tells my story.
I speak out against slavery. You could have done so much more if you only had time. And when my time is up, have I done enough? Will they tell our story? Oh, can I show you what I'm proudest of?
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Yeah, the whole play is like that. Okay, so here, it's not the end though. Okay, because that orphanage that she founded 220 years ago, okay, it is still alive today. Over the next 220 years, at one time when she was there, it had over 700 orphanages in there. And we know senators came from there, congressmen, lawyers, doctors. And if you go to New York City today, okay, it's now called Graham Wyndham. It is all over the city. It's in Manhattan. It's in the Bronx. It's in Harlem. Their budget last year was $53 million. And it all began from what Eliza Hamilton caught from Lawrence, from her husband. I'm telling you, there will never come an end to the good she has done. And it's the story of all of us. Each one of us here have been given a torch that we are meant to carry. And what I'm saying to you is, like Lawrence, who most people don't know about, or Hamilton, or Eliza, they are aiming for, just like we should all should aim for, our highest ideals, the better angels of our nature. And it's planting seeds in the garden that you and I will never get a chance to see. But our word says, okay, a light shines in the darkness for those who are merciful and kind and good. Because what they do and what we do will be remembered forever. And so it is with you. Let's pray. Lord, when the chapters of our lives are done, and our torch has been passed, and our days are spent, years from now, let it be said of us, when those who look at our lives, they would know that our one great desire that we want them to see is that our hearts look like yours in the end. And we know your word says, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has possibly conceived what you have prepared for those who love you. It's in your name we ask and pray these things. Amen. Let's stand and sing together.